Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is from the University of Chicago News, news at uchicago.edu. U.S. prison labor programs violate fundamental human rights, new report finds. Law School's Global Human Rights Clinic, ACLU, examined coercion, exploitation in prison labor. Incarcerated workers generate billions of dollars worth of goods and services annually, but are paid pennies per hour without proper training or opportunity to build skills for careers after release, according to a comprehensive nationwide report released by the University of Chicago Law School Global Human Rights Clinic and the American Civil Liberties Union. The first of its kind report, Captive Labor, Exploitation of Incarcerated Workers, examines the use of prison labor throughout the U.S. and highlights how incarcerated worker labor helps maintain prisons and provide vital public services. Captive labor also calls for far-reaching reforms to ensure prison labor is truly voluntary and that incarcerated workers are paid fairly, properly trained, and able to gain transferable skills. As our report describes in detail, the labor conditions of incarcerated workers in many U.S. prisons violate the most fundamental human rights to life and dignity, said clinical professor Claudia Flores, the director of the Global Human Rights Clinic. In any other workplace, these conditions would be shockingly and plainly unlawful. The many incarcerated workers were interviewed told us a story after story of inadequate equipment and training, punishments doled out if workers refused to labor, and on overall helplessness to a government institution functioning as both jailer and boss. Key findings include nearly two-thirds, 65% of the incarcerated people report working behind bars, amounting to roughly 800,000 workers incarcerated in prisons. More than three-quarters of incarcerated people surveyed report facing punishment such as solitary confinement, denial of sentence reductions, and loss of family visitation if they decline to work. Prison laborers are at the mercy of their employees. They have no control over their work assignments, are excluded from minimum wage and overtime protections, are unable to unionize, do not receive adequate training and equipment, and are denied workplace safety guarantees despite often dangerous working conditions. As a result, 64% of incarcerated workers surveyed report worrying about their safety while working. 70% say they receive no formal job training, and 70% report not being able to afford basic necessities like soap and phone calls with prison labor wages. Incarcerated workers produce at least $2 billion in goods and $9 billion worth of prison maintenance services annually. But the number is not closely tracked and is likely much higher. Yet, most states pay incarcerated workers penny per hour for their work. Seven states, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas, pay nothing for the vast majority of prison work. Other states pay on the average of 15 to 52 cents an hour for non-industry jobs. Prison laborers often see up to 80% of their paychecks withheld for taxes, room and board expenses, and court costs. More than 80% of the prison laborers do general prison maintenance, which subsidize the cost of our bloated prison system. Other tasks represent 10% of the work assignment, including public works projects like road repair, natural disaster assistance, forestry work, and maintenance of parks, schools, and government offices, state prison industries, agricultural work, and coveted private company work assignments. The United States has a long problematic history of using incarcerated workers as a source of cheap labor to subsidize the cost of our bloated prison system, said Jennifer Turner, principal human rights researcher with the ACLU Human Rights Program. Incarcerated workers are stripped of even the most minimal protections against labor, exploitation, and abuse. They are paid pennies for their work, even as they produce billions of dollars for states and federal governments. It's past time we treat incarcerated workers with dignity. If states and the federal government can't afford to incarcerate 1.2 million people, they can afford to pay them fairly for their work. The exploitation of incarcerated workers is rooted in the exception clause of the 13th Amendment, which bars slavery except for people who have been convicted of crimes. In many states and in the United States Constitution, exception clauses allow for workers in prisons to be exploited, unpaid, and excluded from workplace safety protection laws. Worse, the exception clause of the 13th Amendment disproportionately encourages the criminalization of re-enslavement of black people during the Jim Crow era. We still feel the impact of that systemic racism to this day in the disproportionate incarceration of black and brown community members. To combat the exploitation of incarcerated workers, the report makes several recommendations, including ensure that all work in prisons is fully voluntary by eliminating any laws and policies that punish incarcerated people who are unable or unwilling to work. Allow incarcerated workers the same labor protections afforded to other workers in the United States, including minimum wage, health and safety standards, unionization, protection from discrimination, and speedy access to redress when their rights are violated. Institute comprehensive safety and training programs for all work assignments in correctional institutions. Invest in prison work programs that provide incarcerated workers with marketable skills and training that will help them find employment after release and eliminate barriers of employment after release. Amend the U.S. Constitution to abolish the 13th Amendment exclusion that allows slavery and involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime. Captive labor. Exploitation of incarcerated workers comes more than 2 years into the COVID-19 pandemic, during which incarcerated workers faced especially brutal working conditions and yet were denied early access to vaccines in 16 states. Incarcerated people were forced to produce masks, hand sanitizer, and other personal protective equipment. Others were forced to launder bed sheets and gowns from hospitals treating COVID patients, transport bodies, and dig graves. Many report being forced to continue working but not able to have visitors and having their parole date pushed back as if they refused to work. More than a third of the incarcerated people have contracted COVID-19 since the pandemic started, and more than 3,000 have died. The U.S. prison system claims to offer rehabilitation to its population, but prison labor programs do just the opposite. They degrade, dehumanize, and further cripple incarcerated workers, said Marina Ozala Rosenblatt, a University of Chicago lecturer in law and fellow at the Global Human Rights Clinic. The many incarcerated workers we interviewed voiced a strong desire to engage positively in society under dignified conditions. It's time for the U.S. government and prison authorities to give them the chance, not merely rhetorically, but in practice. The law school's Global Human Rights Clinic partner with human rights and civil rights organizations around the world to conduct investigations, develop strategies, and advocate for human rights before internal, national, and local decision makers and stakeholders. The Captive Labor Report reflects the work of three generations of GHRC students, faculty, and staff. From 2018 to 2022, the clinic team conducted extensive search and completed drafting of a report highlighting the violations of the human rights of incarcerated workers in the United States. They analyzed state and federal laws, policies, and practice that result in the violations of international human rights standards and detailed the multiple exploitative aspects of prison labor as recounted by incarcerated workers themselves. The clinic also provided a set of recommendations for federal, state, and local governments, state departments, and corrections, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, correctional authorities, and private companies involved in prison labor. In addition to contributing to the drafting and research of the report, the clinic filed Freedom of Information requests in 50 states, surveyed more than 100 workers currently behind bars in three states, Illinois, Louisiana, and California, completed a fact-finding trip to Louisiana in March 2020, and conducted 65 interviews with key stakeholders, including experts, formerly incarcerated individuals, representatives of advocacy organizations, academics, and leaders of reentry organizations across the country. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
Okay, five Americans who were wrongly held captive in Iran are now on their way back home. They were released as part of a prisoner exchange that saw the United States free five Iranians convicted of crimes in the United States, as well as the United States unfreezing $6 billion in oil revenue. All of this coincides with the one-year anniversary of the murder of Mahsa Amini, the 22-year-old Iranian woman who died in police custody after she was detained by the government's morality police for not wearing a hijab in accordance with government rules. Her death set into motion an historic wave of citizen protests inside Iran, with women and men in Iran protesting, women bravely taking off their hijabs in defiance of the Iranian regime. Perhaps there is no better person that we have access to talk about what's happening on the ground, what's happening to women and their parents and children and boys than Mahsa Alinejad. She has been a voice for the voiceless, for the shut out of the conversation humans in Iran, where she has been exiled, and she's now a target of that country's oppressive government. Earlier in the year, three men with ties to the Iranian regime were charged by the Department of Justice in a murder-for-hire plot targeting her. And last week, she revealed that she was advised to go into witness protection for her own safety. Mahsa Alinejad has not taken up that advice, and she does not plan to. She joins us now.
It's how, not in my DNA.
No, I know. I mean, when I read that, I told you in the break, I had two minds. I'm happy they're trying to protect you, and two, have they met you?
To be honest, when I read the email, I was excited that, wow, this is, you know, my adopted country. They're trying to protect me because they said that high-level protection. I was like, wow. And then in a conversation on the phone, I found out this is witness protection. It means, for those of you, if you don't have any idea what witness protection means, that I have to change my name, my identity, my maybe appearance, and go in hiding, into hiding, like just get disappeared. This is not in my DNA. I want to be loud. I want to give voice to voiceless people.
And I think I understand the why. I mean, we've talked about how difficult it is for us to cover what's happening in Iran, and you are their voice. So even if you wouldn't do it for yourself, I feel like you wouldn't do it for them.
Not at all. Look, right now that I'm talking to you, everywhere in the media, they're talking about five Americans got free. I am happy, for sure. But how come that Biden administration gave $6 billion, to me, it's more than $6 billion. My sources tell me it could be $20 billion. So they gave this money to Islamic Republic. But how come? How come they left the one is in the death row, Jamshid Sharmat? He's an American as well. So there are a lot of political prisoners that they want me to give them a voice. Right now that I'm talking to you, the family members of Mahsa Amini and other people who got killed last year, they got arrested. The family members of more than 70 people. So to us Iranians, this $6 billion is a gift to our killers from Biden administration.
It points to the asymmetry of an American administration and an American government that values life so much, negotiating with a regime like the Iranians. It's never going to be equal. It's never going to be fair because they don't value life. And there is no even trade with a country that values it more than anything else.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fair criticism. I want to ask you what you understand about the arrest of Mahsa's father and family.
Mahsa's family got arrested. And as I told you, the family members of other young protesters who got killed got arrested because the Islamic Republic had fear of any potential uprising, and they know that these family members, they can, mobilize people. People can sympathy with their pain and a struggle. But what actually bothers me is that you can't see the news about the family members of these 70 people especially those who got executed. You remember you invited me here. I was begging everyone to stop the Islamic Republic, from executing these protesters. Now their family members are in prison. So that is why I'm saying that all I hear in the West is about a nuclear deal, which I believe that this is allowing the Islamic Republic to bury human rights on their nuclear deal, or about this prisoner swap that nobody talks about, 22,000 innocent protesters who are in prison. So that is why I believe that handing out money to the hostage takers and giving them visa, the Ibrahim Raisi, the butcher who ordered the killing of Mahsa Amini and 1,500 innocent protesters in bloody November and 700 innocent protesters who got killed in women-led revolution recently, he ordered that. Welcome here in New York, and the members of Revolutionary Guards that like coming with him, they are on the terrorist list, which I actually gave some of their names to Jake Sullivan, and I asked them, how come you designate Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organization, but they can come and get visa and, you know, be part of the delegation of Ibrahim Raisi?
So your fundamental issue, and this is the practice that our government engages in, is with separating out, right? The nuclear deal was done separate from, and your point is that if you are living in Iran, you don't separate out what happens to you.
Not at all. Look, you're talking about a regime killed teenagers, killed children. How you trust them? How come you talk to a regime?
And they benefit by the fact that we don't have cameras there. We can't show the world. We can't see it.
Exactly. And about Nitya, let's get back to that. How come you're going to have a deal with a regime that they hide their nuclear activities? They actually cheat. They lie. How do you trust them? But I have a solution. Look, right now that we are talking here, the U.S. citizen, the U.K. citizen, German citizen, French citizen, Swedish citizen, all the citizens of Western countries are being hostage in Iranian prison. They're being used like bargaining chips. Instead of giving them money and sending them signal, then, like, okay, come and get more hostages, get united, downgrade your diplomatic relation. This is how U.S. government should do. They can take the lead. The Western countries, they're looking to the U.S. government. What they do, they're going to follow. Right now, I'm sure that more money is going to go to Islamic Revolutionary Guards to kill innocent people in the name of prisoner swap. This is a betrayal, total betrayal. This is a slap in the face of Mahsa Amini and other innocent prisoners who are in prison right now.
They're so lucky to have you and your voice for them. Thank you.
That's why I don't want to go into hiding. And you have to bring the White House here to talk to.
I read it, and I told you, I am sure they are right about the threats to her, and I'm sure they haven't met her yet if they think she would ever go.
Never, never. I refuse to be silent. And thank you so much for not abandoning Iranian women. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Thank you.
Of slavery, our people sold out to Babylon. They tried to trick us out of our land, but not the trade. So go back to Babylon, not the dogo. Remember the pain and the suffering, judge our children there in Babylon. They tried to change our power plan.
By public employees. This is a question of judgment. Few would say it's unreasonable to keep Hustler, with its close-up genital photographs, out of school libraries, and few would insist that Romeo and Juliet, with its lyrical allusions to sex, should be removed. Communities must draw the line somewhere between those two points. But where exactly? Take the previously mentioned book, Genderqueer. That graphic novel famously includes a picture of a strap-on dildo blowjob. Is this okay for kids? Some think that it is, and some think that it isn't. You know something weird is going on, though, when parents try to read passages of these books at school board meetings, and the school board cuts them off because they insist the material is too obscene to be read out loud. I guess kids could be listening? Great for them to read, but unacceptable for them to hear? I think that's the principle, maybe. It's kind of gross.
I can explain what the principle is. When you take a book out of the library and you decide to read it, you are making a decision to read it. when you are in a public forum and you're listening to that forum, when somebody starts reading something that's explicit, you don't have the same control over that. I guess theoretically you could turn it off, but if you're actually located in the building, what are you, going to have to run out of the room? This is very different. I mean, I think this is a fairly straightforward concept. I can make a personal choice for me. I can't necessarily make that choice without informed consent. I guess if you were saying, like, at the meeting tonight, some parent's going to try and read off stuff that some people may find offensive. Don't come if you don't want to hear that. I think that's fair. I think that's called a trigger warning, which these same people mock you for offering. All right, but go back. Let's listen to this guy, because he's about to now, so protective of our children, read this in a public area.
And the school board cuts them off because they insist the material is too obscene to be read out loud. I guess kids could be listening. Great for them to read, but unacceptable for them to hear. I think that's the principle, maybe. It's kind of gross to say, and I don't want to, but this hearing has been called, and we really can't have an honest discussion without knowing what we're actually talking about. We're talking about books with explicit passages about fisting, butt plugs, analingus, the spit or swallow decision, and rape. I won't read those verbatim, but I will read a passage from a few of the most banned books. From the fourth most banned, All Boys Aren't Blue. You were fully erect at this point. You promised that you're not going to tell anyone? I promised. You then grabbed my hand and made me touch it. It was the first time I'd ever touched a penis that wasn't my own. I knew that what was happening wasn't supposed to happen. Cousins weren't supposed to do these things with cousins. And from the also fourth most banned, Lawn Boy. In the fourth grade at a church youth group meeting, out in the bushes behind the parsonage, I touched Doug Goebel's dick, and he touched mine. In fact, there were even some mouths involved. 10-year-olds performing sodomy, underage incest, strap-on dildo blowjobs. Is this okay for kids?
I confess I'm a little confused, and I appreciate the argument discussion that we've been having, but for me it's a little too conceptual, or I don't know, metaphysical or theological or whatever you want to call it. I want to try to understand what you're asking us to do.
I like how he, I don't know, some of these big words. Where did he go to school? Was it Yale or was it Harvard?
He's Harvard, but he's also a Rhodes Scholar, just to be clear.
Plantation, even plow the earth. They work them and work them. They work them to death. Now they wanna come play the same trick on us. They ain't gonna play the same trick on us. Boy, I'm so wicked. Back where you are vampire. Back where. Back where you are vampire, I look into my history. I will feed my heart, make my blood run cold, and I feel I cry. Plantation, even plow the herd, hey, they work them and work them, they work them to death, now.
Hello there, you Awakening Wonders. Now, this isn't the usual type of video we make on this channel where we critique, attack, and undermine the news in all its corruption, because in this story, I am the news. I've received two extremely disturbing letters, or a letter and an email, one from a mainstream media TV company, one from a newspaper, listing a litany of extremely egregious and aggressive attacks, as well as some pretty stupid stuff, like my community festival should be stopped, that I shouldn't be able to attack mainstream media narratives on this channel. But amidst this litany of astonishing, rather baroque attacks are some very serious allegations that I absolutely refute. These allegations pertain to the time when I was working in the mainstream, when I was in the newspapers all the time, when I was in the movies. And as I've written about extensively in my books, I was very, very promiscuous. Now, during that time of promiscuity, the relationships I had were absolutely always consensual. I was always transparent about that then, almost too transparent. And I'm being transparent about it now as well. And to see that transparency metastasized into something criminal that I absolutely deny makes me question, is there another agenda at play? Particularly when we've seen coordinated media attacks before, like with Joe Rogan when he dared to take a medicine that the mainstream media didn't approve of, and we saw a spate of headlines from media outlets across the world using the same language. I'm aware that you guys have been saying in the comments for a while, watch out, Russell, they're coming for you, you're getting too close to the truth, Russell Brand did not kill himself. I know that a year ago there was a spate of articles, Russell Brand's a conspiracy theorist, Russell Brand's right wing. I'm aware of news media making phone calls, sending letters to people I know. For ages and ages, it's been clear to me, or at least it feels to me, like there's a serious and concerted agenda to control these kind of spaces and these kind of voices. And I mean my voice along with your voice. I don't mind them using my books and my stand-up to talk about my promiscuous, consensual conduct in the past. What I seriously refute are these very, very serious criminal allegations. Also, it's worth mentioning that there are witnesses whose evidence directly contradicts the narratives that these two mainstream media outlets are trying to construct, apparently in what seems to me to be a coordinated attack. Now, I don't want to get into this any further because of the serious nature of the allegations, but I feel like I'm being attacked, and plainly they are working very closely together. We are obviously going to look into this matter because it's very, very serious. In the meantime, I want you to stay close, stay awake, but more important than any of that, if you can, please stay free.
If you ever get trial by television or guilt by accusation, that day, freedom dies.
All I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes.
On the evening of Sunday, January 2nd, 2021, Donald Trump made a phone call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, the person in charge of overseeing the results of the contested outcome of the presidential election and vote count in Georgia. But we all know Trump's not the brightest bulb on the tree. You know, he didn't just come up with these ideas out of thin air, that 5,000 dead people voted or hundreds of thousands of ballots were dumped in Fulton County. That phone call on January 2nd and the resulting insurrection were decades in the making, the result of work by major Republican leaders, as well as a number of shadowy figures and millions of dollars of dark money, all in an effort to undermine our democratic elections and systematically disenfranchise as many people as possible. This is why Republicans are obsessed with voter fraud. Alarmism about election fraud reaches at least as far back as when people other than white men were first allowed to vote in this country. After the Civil War, the 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote, and in response, white Southerners worked to disenfranchise black voters and politicians by accusing them of corruption and making it harder to vote. Poll taxes made voting impossible for low-income black voters. Literacy tests were an ostensibly race-neutral way to bar formerly enslaved people who were never taught to read and whose access to education was limited from the vote. Grandfather clauses also barred black voters without having to mention race because these clauses restricted voting rights to men whose male ancestors were allowed to vote, clearly meant to target voters who were just given voting rights through the passage of the 15th Amendment. It wasn't until nearly a century later that the 24th Amendment, passed in 1964, banned the use of poll taxes. In the wake of the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that further solidified access to voting rights for historically disenfranchised people, white conservatives were openly hostile to the spread of democracy in the United States. Paul Weyrich, who helped establish the Heritage Foundation and the Moral Majority, admitted, "I don't want everybody to vote. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down." That's right, conservatives have known for decades that the fewer people who can vote, the more likely conservatives are to win elections. And so Republicans are able to use worries about the validity of our elections, about voter fraud, to undermine access to the vote and make it harder, especially for traditionally liberal voters to vote, like black folks, immigrants, and poor people. And so despite the protections of the 24th Amendment and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which guarantees the right to vote and outlaws discriminatory voting practices adopted by many southern states after the Civil War, conservatives have continued to devise sneakier ways to bar these undesirables from being able to vote.
Now I cry myself to sleep. In my dreams I often weep. My children are hungry and my back in pain. And yet they come to rap again.
It's unfair. When it comes to Africa, the world don't care. Some poor people have no clothes to wear. Some walk naked, some foot bare. Food, aid, aeroplanes flying in the air. White sacks of maize feeding refugees. Babies dying from terrible disease. Western politics, African conflict. Divide and rule tactics, practice. Divide and rule tactics, practice.
Pimps and pips in Italian castles. Stop rapping Africa like she's your prostitute. To Mr. Oil, diamond and gold mine. Stop rapping Mama Africa like a vagina.
Mama Gina,
the ho-ho, not anymore. You take the riches and you leave the people poor. To Mr. Oil, diamond and gold mine. Stop rapping Mama Africa like a vagina.
Mama Gina, the ho-ho, not anymore. You take the riches and you leave the people poor.
Never ever forget the genocide in Rwanda. Soldiers is broken heart in Uganda. Massacre taking place in Sudan. Young girls and women getting raped even now. Young children walking in the minefields. Politicians allowing in bad deals. And then they kill and then they kill. And due to your pressure the innocent suffer.
To Mr. Oil, diamond and gold mine.
But who's pulling the strings? Who's paying for the civil wars and uprisings? Who's benefiting from our sufferings? Could it be Mr. Oil, Diamond and Gold Miner? Who's treating Africa like it's their
vagina?
Or is it the pharmaceutical companies? Beneficiaries of the dreaded ATD? Or arm dealers who hate peace treaty? Faceless, shameless, and they remain nameless. One thing for sure, they won't remain blameless. One thing for sure, they won't remain blameless. One thing for sure, they won't remain blameless.
To Mr. Oil, diamond and gold mine. Gold mine. Rapping Mama Africa like a vagina.
Mama Gina,
the ho-ho, not anymore. You take the riches and you leave the people poor. To Mr. Oil, diamond and gold mine.
Gold mine.
Rapping Mama Africa like a vagina.
Mama Gina, the ho-ho, not anymore. You take the riches and you leave the people poor.
That. Them still a rabbit from a land, them say the kitty fat. Them violate the human rights, them not checking for that. They mashing up the ozone layer, claiming ownership of minerals and artifacts. Babies are born baptized in bloodshed, genocide for the gold, diamonds and the oil spread. Millions of orphans with no hope under the sun. Discovery savages ravaged the motherland, they start fun fire.
For Mr. Oil, diamonds and gold mine.
This continued through the 20th century. For example, in the 1980s, the Republican National Committee was sued for trying to intimidate black voters by challenging their registration or posting off-duty police officers at polling places. But Republicans have gotten sneakier, better at using wedge issues and fear-mongering to get their base to believe anything they say. And with the combination of growing partisanship, a large immigrant population, Fox News, the influx of dark money into politics and elections, and some of the closest elections in U.S. history, the 21st century has only ramped up the Republican disenfranchisement campaign. The 2000 election between Al Gore and George Bush provided ample fodder for spreading fear about voting fraud across the country. Republicans blamed fraud for narrow defeats in New Mexico, where Bush lost by just a few hundred votes, and Missouri, where incumbent Senator John Ashcroft lost his re-election campaign to a dead man, which is, of course, easy to spin as a grand voting fraud conspiracy, but the reality is that Ashcroft's opponent, Mel Carnahan, died 3 weeks before the election in a plane crash, too soon before the election to remove his name from the ballot, and his wife ran in his stead. So despite the fact that the Missouri senior Republican Senator Kit Bond declared at Ashcroft's election night party that Democrats in the city of St. Louis are trying to steal this election, the reality was that Ashcroft simply ran such a weak campaign that he lost fair and square to a dead man. Ashcroft would go on to become the Attorney General under Bush, and during his tenure as Attorney General, he became obsessed with rooting out voter fraud. And he was aided by the 2000 election itself. Some scholars theorize that the close election in 2000, decided by a few votes in Florida, primed Americans to believe that a small handful of voters, and thus a small amount of fraud, can change the course of history, even though that's rarely the case. Ahead of the 2004 re-election campaign for Bush, the DOJ ramped up its crusade against voter fraud. Bush's top political advisor, Karl Rove, frequently warned of voter fraud, saying at one point, "We are, in some parts of the country, I'm afraid to say, beginning to look like we have elections like those run in countries where the guys in charge are, you know, colonels in mirrored sunglasses. I mean, it's a real problem." The result of all this, the accusations that entire elections were being swayed by voter fraud, that it was a systemic and widespread problem, was 86 total convictions by the Justice Department over 8 years. Many of them were honest mistakes, such as older folks who retire to a different state and don't know the voting laws, or people registering to vote accidentally while renewing their driver's licenses despite being non-citizens, or people voting while on probation. 86 total convictions. Far from the election-altering widespread fraud that Republicans had been warning voters about. But that didn't matter, because hard facts and data rarely do in these situations. One group that became the focus of particular Republican ire was called ACORN, a now-shuttered advocacy organization that was working to register hundreds of thousands of low-income voters, which scared the shit out of swing state Republicans who knew that when more people vote, when the vote is expanded to include more people, conservatives statistically tend to lose. So they quickly came up with theories that ACORN was manufacturing voters, with Rush Limbaugh stating that ACORN has been training young black kids to hate, hate, hate this country. That's right, nothing says, "I hate this country," quite like standing in line to cast your Democratic vote. A few weeks before the 2008 election between John McCain and Barack Obama, during the second presidential debate, McCain claimed that ACORN is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying the fabric of democracy. The Republican Party would go on to devote the last weeks of the election to a voter fraud scare campaign, focusing on ACORN as the villain.
Massive voter fraud. And the Obama campaign paid more than $800,000 to an ACORN front for get-out-the-vote efforts.
And when Obama won that election, boy howdy, did that give conservatives a scare. A black man with that name in our White House? It's bad enough that blacks and immigrants can vote, but the fact that this person is now the president is all the evidence that they needed to confirm that elections were in fact being hijacked systematically at every level, because there is no way that real Americans would vote for someone like that. 2 years later, a scandal stoked by right-wing conspiracy theorists led to the shuttering of ACORN after Congress stripped it of federal funding. The accusations against ACORN have since been discredited. But the ACORN myth persisted. After the 2012 election, one survey found that 49% of Republican voters said they thought ACORN had stolen the presidential election from Mitt Romney, despite the fact that ACORN had been shut down for 2 years at that point. And these talking points from Bush to Ashcroft to McCain to Trump have been orchestrated not just by Fox News pundits and conspiracy theorists on the internet, but also by fringe groups and unknown figures who wield outsized influence over local and national politics, despite the fact that most of us have never heard of them. Take Chris Kobach, for example. Kobach is the current Attorney General of Kansas, and he has played an outsized role in rolling back voting rights in that state and across the country. This man is a maniac, okay? And he's not some fringe conspiracy theorist. He got his bachelor's degree from Harvard. He got a master's from Oxford. And his law degree is from Yale. And it's these very names on his resume that have given him the authority and credence to spread some of the most batshit theories about immigration and voting fraud. Kobach's undergrad thesis advisor at Harvard was a man named Samuel Huntington. Huntington wrote a book in 2004, the central thesis of which was that America's Anglo-Protestant culture was under siege. He warned that, and I quote, "the large and continuing influx of Hispanics threatens the preeminence of white Anglo-Protestant culture and the place of English as the only national language. White nativist movements are a possible and plausible response to these trends." In a later essay he wrote for Foreign Policy, he doubled down, saying, "Demographically, socially, and culturally, the Reconquista, reconquest, of the Southwest United States by Mexican immigrants is well underway."
Babylon, be still, while I blow this trumpet. Babylon, be still. We are good enough to build your city. Yet not good enough to be a part of your society.
Like, what culture is under siege? My dude, racism and hamburgers? They can take it. The only people who are so adamant and fear-mongery about protecting U.S. culture are the ones who've gained money and power from this shithole, plus the voters that they've brainwashed into voting against their own best interests. This is the shit that gets me riled up about the Ivy Leagues, y'all. Harvard gave that man legitimacy by hiring him, and he was able to spread that trash to his students, including Chris Kobach. Kobach became a White House fellow during the George W. Bush administration. He got the job a week before 9/11. That event radicalized him. He saw it as a failure failure of border security. After his fellowship ended a year later, he stayed on to work with Attorney General John Ashcroft as chief advisor on immigration and border security issues. He was key to implementing the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, which required all male visa holders over the age of 16 from 24 predominantly Muslim countries and North Korea to be fingerprinted, photographed, and interviewed by immigration authorities. It's a program that the ACLU condemned, saying it mandated ethnic profiling on a scale not seen in the United States since Japanese-American internment during World War II. Before the program was halted in 2011, it didn't result in a single conviction for terrorism charges, but it did result in deportation proceedings for nearly 14,000 Muslim men, often for minor immigration violations, a record that Kobach today considers a great success. Because the goal isn't actually to root out extremism, it's to keep people who aren't white Christians out. Period. While serving as chairman of the Kansas Republican Party, Kobach also had his hands in Arizona, helping train border security to comply with federal immigration law, aka lessons on how to get away with as much as possible while still being technically within the bounds of the law, maybe. And helping draft Arizona Senate Bill 1070, which required the Arizona police to ask for citizenship papers from anyone they had reasonable suspicion of being in the state illegally, the goal being to make life as miserable as possible for immigrants within technically the bounds of the law so that they'll leave of their own volition. The Show Me Your Papers law was later struck down almost entirely by the Supreme Court. In 2010, Kobach ran for Secretary of State in Kansas, an unglamorous position, but one that wielded particular power over elections. A few days before the election, Kobach called a press conference to claim that 2,000 dead voters in the state were still registered to vote, including one man, Alfred K. Brewer, born in 1900 and died in 1996, but listed as having voted just that year in the 2010 primary election. Scandalous. The problem was that Alfred K. Brewer was very much alive. He was 78, but listed as having been born in 1900 because Kansas didn't record birth dates on voter registration forms back when he first registered. The 1996 death date was that of his father, who had the same name. But Kansas voters, in the midst of Tea Party hysteria and Obama backlash, latched on to Kobach's anti-immigrant, voting-restrictive sentiments. So he won the race. And he got right to work. He was instrumental in spreading state membership to the Interstate Voter Registration Cross-Check Program, a program that compared state records to find people registered to vote in more than one place. It's also a program that's incredibly inaccurate for its lack of data, leading to absurd headlines that have just fueled the conspiracy theories about voter fraud. For example, one headline in North Carolina said that in the 2012 general election, there were 35,750 voters in the state whose first and last names and dates of birth matched those of individuals who voted in the same election in a different state. The headline caused an uproar, with one Fox News pundit saying, "It's the most important data I've read in a year." However, when North Carolina investigated the numbers using additional data like the last four digits of voters' social security numbers, they referred only 8 cases of potential double voting to prosecutors, leading to 2 convictions.
And she didn't know how to tell him she was in love with a Rasta man. Fire was burning and burning. Got what she was holding in, and she didn't know how to tell him she was in love with a Rasta man. Fire was burning and burning. Till I got what she was holding.
Know her story before she said. Daddy just wants her corporate. Find somebody that's corporate. Suit and tie more appropriate. Him say him now make him daughter straight. But reggae music she starts it late. I tell food when she starts her plate. Militant youth where she won't be date. And that is what she need. Marcus Garvey she starts to read. Here stop home and it starts to neat. So we won't keep her off the street. From who she with and that be me. More than a nasty head is what she see. No love and sleep is not for me. And she no won't keep it a secret. But she can't tell him who she sleep with.
She didn't know how to tell him she was in love with a Rasta man. Fire was burning and burning. To let out what she was holding in.
She wants to be free, from all this captivity. So she'll be who she will be. They can't tell her who she need. They can't tell her who she want. Who she can. She talk her own a chant. Chart her own a path. And color her own a art. Call me over her own apartment. Now as I answer the phone, that's the tone she talk with. She knows that she don't be pop with one like I, even though so much imparted. But she happy do her own a thing,
yeah.
Cause she can never live life for them,
not
knowing that she will look back when. So yeah, the time when she couldn't explain to him and them.
And she didn't know, just tell him.
But the damage was done. Now there was a headline people could point to that said that there were 35,750 proven double voters in North Carolina. A 2016 paper analyzed the lists of potential duplicate voter registrations that CrossCheck sent to the state of Iowa and found that 200 legitimate voters may be impeded from voting for every double vote stopped. 200. It's a convenient way to disenfranchise voters, which, as we know, usually works in Republicans' favor. And Kobach wasn't done. In 2015, he convinced the Kansas legislature to make him the only Secretary of State in the country with the power to independently prosecute voter fraud cases. However, despite his claims that this was necessary to prevent massive fraud, he won a total of 9 convictions between 2015 and 2017, most of whom were citizens over 60 who owned property in 2 states and were confused about voting requirements. Quite the conspiracy. Then the 2016 election happened, and it turns out that Kobach's star was still rising. Trump has long been a conspiracy theorist of sorts, and his days of sitting glued to Fox News likely didn't begin when he entered the White House. So he spent years before the 2016 election being fed the same voter fraud lie that all Republicans were being fed, especially after the 2000 election. He was actively questioning Obama's citizenship along with everyone else in the birther movement after 2008. And he was yelling about crooked Hillary for years before it became a campaign slogan. So it's no surprise that in the weeks leading up to the 2016 election, especially when so many people wrote him off as incapable of beating Hillary Clinton, remember those days? He leaned hard into the voter fraud rhetoric. He claimed dead people were voting. He asked his supporters to sign up to be poll watchers, the same thing that the RNC was sued for in the 80s. He was mirroring McCain's rhetoric in the lead-up to the 2008 election when he said there would be massive voter fraud ahead of the 2016 election. And this was a tactic both to whip his base into a voting frenzy, but also to save face if he lost in 2016, which is exactly what he did when he lost the popular vote in 2016, tweeting on November 27th, 2016, "I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally." Trump's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, was asked in an ABC interview where Trump got that information. Her answer? Chris Kobach. The old Chris had an in with the Trumps because he had a few mutual friends with Don Jr., which led to an introduction to the big guy himself. Another reason why we need to abolish the Ivy Leagues. It brings too many rich people and also lunatic people together and then gives them a scab of legitimacy. So when Trump convened a presidential commission on election integrity after 2016, Kobach was the perfect fit to take over as the vice chairman. The commission was later quietly disbanded after uncovering zero evidence of fraudulent votes being cast. And Kobach is just one example in the web of unknown people who've had a hand in this conversation for a very long time. I felt like that meme of Charlie from Always Sunny while I was researching this because the connections run so deep it would take a feature-length film to untangle them all.
Holding me, let's go, I need.
tell you a story about a really cool friend that I have. This person dresses really slick, always says the right thing, dates the hottest people. My friend can win in any fight. And guess what? That person is me! That's basically the argument of Fight Club. One guy telling us about how cool someone is, then revealing that, actually, that guy is me. How come when we watch a movie that makes that argument, it's compelling? But if someone did that to you in person, you'd think they're a garbage person. Maybe if we look a little closer at Fight Club, we can figure it out. The standard reading of Fight Club is that Jack is schizophrenic, that he invents Tyler as an alternate personality out of either boredom or a sense of inferiority. And then the Tyler personality takes over Jack's mind for a while, does a bunch of terrorist stuff, but eventually Jack saves the day. Even though society seems like it's about to crumble, the bad man is sent away. It's a happy ending, right? But I would like to propose a different reading. That this is a story told by Tyler from the very beginning.
This is it. The beginning.
That the personality of Jack never existed within the fictional world. Tyler is real. Jack is a character invented by Tyler to manipulate us, the audience. Talking about a fictional character within a fictional story can be a bit confusing, so we need to go over some concepts first. I've always felt that I'm not alone when I watch a movie or TV or a YouTube video. The person on screen is talking to me, even though I know they're just pixels flashing on a monitor and vibrations emanating from speakers. Welcome. I know that they're not really here, that all these characters and places are absent, but I know that these images and sounds represent people, places, and emotions. I know that they are present. This is known as absence presence. Some movies are so clever they'll even draw attention to their own absence presence.
We have front row seats for this theater of mass destruction.
That we is Jack and Tyler, but we is also us, the audience. The disembodied voiceover acknowledges that we're aware we're about to watch a show. Then we impossibly float through walls in a complicated VFX shot. All these things are absent, but at the same time, we feel their presence. As you can find in a basic film studies textbook,
the spectator knows very well that what he is watching is a fiction, but all the same, he maintains the belief, indeed his pleasure is dependent on that belief, that it is not. Cinema is thus founded on a regime of spectating at once knowing one thing and believing its opposite, which, as we have seen, is precisely the structure of disavowal.
The process of disavowal has been described by the formula, I know, but all the same. We know the movie we are watching is not real, but in order to enjoy a movie, we must believe on some level that it is real. By starting with, I know, we seem to acknowledge something or someone's point of view. Then by adding the, but, we disavow what we just claim to know is true. Not every I know, but statement is disavowal, and not every statement of disavowal requires an I know, but. When a politician says, let's not make this political, they are disavowing the fact that everything is inherently political. Dishonest people love disavowal because it makes them seem rational. It's already weird that we're able to follow the average film, following characters from scene to scene across time and space. In Fight Club, Tyler and Jack are a weird, extremely literal manifestation of absence, presence, and disavowal. By the end of the movie, Tyler was popping in and out of existence, even within a single shot. The way characters pop in and out of existence when we change from one scene to another in any movie. By pushing absence, presence, and disavowal into the foreground, Fincher keeps our minds so busy, we forget exactly what it is we're even disavowing. Hint, it's terrorism. And let me pause to say, film theory and psychoanalytic concepts like these are not inherently good or inherently bad. Personally, I'm glad I can enjoy a movie through disavowal. Even a fictional narrative can reveal deeper truths about the human condition. What we need to ask is, what are the effects of a particular film's use of these concepts? And are the implications of the narrative true? So with that in mind, there's one more term we need to cover. Fetishism in pop culture is usually understood as someone getting overtly horny at the sight of an object like a pair of sexy red shoes. Cultural theorist Thomas Yingling wrote that it's more useful to think of fetishism as it has been defined in psychoanalysis, not as the overvaluation of some part object, but as a denial of lack. For example, the American flag is a fetish object, often used to deny a lack of freedom. How can you say I'm not free when I've got this piece of dyed cloth that stands in for freedom? By continually filling his life with Swedish furniture, Jack fills his life with fetish objects that comfort him. Collecting all these objects distracts from what is lacking in his life. And clearly he's lacking something.
Please just give me something.
If only Jack had a friend to tell him what's lacking in his life. Just as Jack fetishizes his furniture, audiences participate in fetishism while watching movies. Film theorist Christian Metz wrote on the subject in the 1970s.
Fetishism occurs on screen within the image, as in the case of the fetishizing of the body of the femme fatale in film noir. But, says Metz, fetishism operates also at a far more basic level. The image as image and the cinematic apparatus are both fetish, because they stand in for, make present, what is absent. As such, they disavow what is lacking.
Just as Jack fetishizes furniture to deny the lack in his own life, we fetishize the cinematic image to deny the lack of reality represented by that image. I know Spider-Man is a fictional character, but when I see him die, I feel like a real person has died. If only we had a movie to tell us what's lacking in our lives. Fight Club is a story told by an unreliable narrator whose goal is to explain away his own guilt and justify the position he's established as the leader of a terrorist organization. An organization he knowingly and willingly created because he wants the rest of the world to be as miserable as he is. The narrative is told by and controlled by Tyler, Jack isn't Tyler's alter ego or imaginary friend. In Jack, Tyler has created the perfect candidate for Project Mayhem, confident that we will see ourselves in Jack, that we will identify with Jack's insecurities, doubts about society, and fear of self-examination. In a 1999 interview, Fincher speaks to Tyler's embodiment of disavowal.
You have to have a guy that's going, well, I can see your point, but it seems to me you can look at losing all of your stuff both ways. Yeah, it's all of your stuff. Yeah, it took you years to collect. Yes, they were all tasteful, interesting choices, but there's another side to it.
Tyler anticipates our moral reservations, lays them out in a very childish terms, and then goes, but, and gives Jack a prepackaged, simplistic counterargument.
I say, look, let's evolve. Chips fall where they may.
Okay, whatever that means. Tyler needs to invent the character of Jack to give us a friendly, gullible fetish object to identify with. Jack is the image we can attach ourselves to so that we can tell ourselves that we, just like Jack, were innocent all along. We are free to enjoy the violence, even up to and including terrorist acts, because in the end we see Jack's image standing there, victorious. The image of Jack remains, although he now admits that he's Tyler. Jack's image is present, but Jack is absent. Tyler's image is absent, but Tyler is present. By ending on Jack's image, we deny the lack of morality in what Tyler has done.
Everything's gonna be fine.
We can deny that this power fantasy is appealing to guys like you and me because the good guy, or at least the image of the good guy, is the one left standing in the end. Also, that's not how schizophrenia works. Fight Club is a movie that's clearly designed to be watched multiple times, but with each viewing, we disavow more and more. The first viewing is exciting. We, the audience, experience revelation after revelation along with Jack, up until we learn that Tyler is Jack. Usually, when we watch a movie for a second time, we're able to break down a story structure a little bit better and recognize key themes more clearly. We start to see the strings. It's why The Sixth Sense is kind of boring on the second viewing, because now you're just paying attention to how M. Night Shyamalan pulled it off. But that's not the experience of watching Fight Club for a second time. As viewers, solving a mystery is both entertaining and comforting. We want to understand what really happened in this fictional universe, and Tyler lays out a pretty fun, sardonic, flashy answer to the mystery of who is Tyler Durden. Once we feel like we have that answer, even though it is just Tyler's version of what happened in this fictional narrative, we get to sit back on this second viewing and just enjoy the ride. However, repeat viewings do not give us a deeper understanding of Marla's perspective, even though she would have a pretty insightful view of Tyler. A view that we should want if we truly wanted to understand him more accurately, or understand the deeper implications of the story. But we don't. Instead, Tyler frames her emotions as the butt of a mean joke, while seeing his emotions as valid. On repeat viewing, instead of breaking down the movie, we're sucked deeper into Tyler's narrative, deeper into his perspective. We're not just seeing puzzle pieces fit together in the order that Tyler has preordained. We're feeling how he wants us to feel about every character. Rewatching scenes with Marla, which should make us empathize with her since we now know that Tyler is treating her like garbage, instead make her the object of ridicule. Fincher's choice of angles, tone, and pacing still privilege Tyler's point of view. Look how often Marla is framed with the camera looking down on her. And how often Tyler is framed looking down on us. We are rewatching the exact same scene we saw on the first viewing, telling ourselves that we're watching something different this time, since we have new knowledge. But the same argument as before, that Marla is trash and sucks and Tyler hates her and we should hate her too, is only reinforced on this viewing. Jack's inflection seems clueless.
What are you getting out of all this?
On the first viewing, that inflection was understood to be Jack's honest confusion about why Marla is hanging around Tyler. On the second viewing, there's a surface-level reading if we take Tyler's narrative at his word that Jack is schizophrenic and is truly confused. But that's not what's going on, because Jack is not there. Jack is absent. That's Tyler talking. Tyler is present. Tyler is telling us this story. By acting confused, Tyler keeps us from empathizing with Marla in this situation, and instead we empathize with Jack, because we've seen the scene before and we were just as confused as he is. It's relatable. It keeps us from acknowledging that in the actual world of the story, it's Marla who is infinitely more confused because she's dealing with this irrational, obnoxious person. Knows exactly how much of his asshole persona he can reveal without losing his intended audience.
This conversation is over. It's over.
And this movie has an intended audience. This movie is not meant for everyone. This movie is meant for guys like you and me. It's for nice guys who know they should be getting more out of life.
And I used to be such a nice guy.
Except Jack was never a nice guy, because he never existed. The mythical nice guy is simply a convenient tool in Tyler's rhetorical utility belt. This movie is for guys who were never nice, but want to claim, it's the world's fault that I'm not nice anymore. Guys who want a fabricated excuse for their toxic, abusive behavior. On the fourth viewing, Marla is still gross. On the sixth viewing, Jack still provides excuses for Tyler's actions. On the eighth viewing, we still disavow that Brad Pitt is a Hollywood sex symbol so that we can pretend he's just a regular guy like us. Because no matter how many times you watch it, Tyler is still in control of the story. At best, the narrative constructs him as a messiah. At worst, he's misguided but still right about society.
Wink.
Tyler narrates scenes that literally did not happen so that we don't even have a chance to question Tyler's lies. Tyler has to show us the provocative fight first. After all, seeing someone assaulting themselves or pretending to be assaulted in public would make them seem ridiculous. This is provocative.
Assault! They're assaulting me! They're attacking me!
But from a more objective angle, we see it's simply a dork pretending to get beat up.
I'm being pushed! I'm under assault!
By the time Tyler shows us this, he's preached so much about how terrible, absurd, and messed up society is. We're primed to see this kind of behavior as justified, or even noble. If society is absurd, the means of rebelling might as well be equally absurd. That's why even on repeat viewings, when we know that Tyler is punching himself in this scene, we don't think, that's a sad guy punching himself. We still think, this is cool and funny and different. And this is the origin story of that cool secret club I know about. We disavow critical thought in favor of being part of the in-group.
Losing all hope was freedom.
Tyler talks a lot about freedom, about being free. But the kind of freedom Tyler is talking about isn't found in Enlightenment philosophy or the Declaration of Independence or even in ads for oversized American pickup trucks. Journalist I.A.R. Wiley interviewed a young man who could have been a real-life candidate for Project Mayhem when he said, "We are free from freedom." Wiley elaborates.
He meant that he no longer had to make his own decisions or even think his own thoughts.
Wiley was interviewing a young Nazi who made that proud statement shortly before World War II. Eric Hoffer in The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements, explains that this kind of freedom
is not the freedom of self-expression and self-realization, but freedom from the terrible burden of an autonomous existence. They want freedom from the fearful burden of free choice.
It's only after we've lost everything that we're free to do anything.
The idea of free will or free choice is antithetical to Tyler's worldview. Freedom means having a gun placed at the back of your head by a stranger and being told what to do. And conveniently for Tyler, he sets up a system which strips everyone else of choice, leaving Tyler with the ability to choose for them. You are free to punch, you are free to blow things up, but you are not free to do just anything. To Tyler, these violent physical categories of knowledge are good, but there are categories of knowledge which he finds distasteful, which he wants to eliminate.
Why do guys like you and I know what a duvet is?
Simply knowing what the word duvet means is immoral to Tyler. Guys like you and me should not be allowed to know what a duvet is. We are men. We are hard. Duvets are prohibited for guys like you and me. Why does Jack feel so empty? Why does Jack feel so lost? Does he feel crushed by the superficiality and alienation inherent in capitalism? Does he have a terminal illness? Is it because the word duvet exists? It's because Jack isn't real. He's a straw man whose mortal enemy is a fancy word for blanket.
Just a little child,
take a closer look at one of the characters Tyler indoctrinates, a character whose life Tyler believes Tyler changes for the better.
What are we doing?
Human sacrifice.
In the only scene where we actually see Tyler intimately engaged with one of his converts, Tyler drags this stranger, Raymond, outside while he's working and puts a gun to the back of Raymond's head. Then, based solely on the fact that Raymond has an expired community college ID in his wallet, Tyler assumes the heck of a lot about Raymond's hopes and dreams, gets him to admit under duress that he gave up his goal of being a veterinarian, then threatens that if Raymond doesn't go back to school, Tyler will find Raymond and murder him. Just very, very inspiring stuff. We know that Tyler just wants to push this guy to be his best self. We know that Tyler is trying to motivate men to be men, to take charge of their lives. We know this because Tyler knows this. Raymond does not know this. We do not know Raymond's perspective. We do not establish his mundane job. We do not see him standing behind the counter as Tyler rushes in like an ordinary robber. If we heard Raymond's side of the story, he would tell us about a time a lunatic robbed him, spouted a bunch of pseudo-philosophical BS.
The question, Raymond, was what did you want to be?
Only stole his driver's license and then left. Tyler tells us a story about how Tyler is a messiah. We are left assuming that Tyler changed this man's life for the better. We do not know that. Whether or not Raymond actually gets his degree doesn't matter.
Imagine how he feels.
Tyler doesn't want us to imagine how Raymond actually feels. Tyler wants us to imagine how Tyler wants Raymond to feel.
Tomorrow will be the most beautiful day of Raymond Chaos's life. His breakfast will taste better than any meal you and I have ever tasted.
In reality, Raymond is not liberated. In reality, Raymond has no choice but to follow Tyler's orders. Raymond hasn't been watching this movie, so Raymond has no reason to trust Tyler, no reason to buy into this arcane plan. Tyler asks Raymond a straightforward question.
Raymond Chaos, 1320 Southeast Banning, Apartment A. Small cramped basement apartment, Raymond.
The answer to his question is yes, but since Tyler is telling the story, Raymond answers,
how did you know?
Tyler is telling us about a time when he robbed someone and pointed a gun at the back of their head. And in telling the story, Tyler needs to emphasize that he knows everything. So he has this person, in the middle of what they think might be their last moments on Earth, praise Tyler's intelligence. Tyler is right about everything.
How did you know? Because they give shitty basement apartments letters instead of numbers.
I don't even know if that's true, but we don't have time to question it. Because Tyler's never wrong.
I just can't win with you, can I?
Tyler wins in every situation, no matter how absurd. Everything Tyler sets out to achieve, he accomplishes. Because this is Tyler's story, and he is the hero.
Tell you are by far the most interesting single-serving friend I've ever met.
Even his victims think so.
How did you know?
Even on the second viewing.
How did you know?
Notice how when Tyler was trying to ask Raymond, what did you want to be, it takes multiple questions and the threat of physical violence.
What'd you study, Raymond? Stuff? Where the midterms are?
But when it comes to praising Tyler, Raymond's response is immediate.
How did you know?
Watching Tyler drift through the story is like watching someone play a video game with God mode on. Raymond's existence in Tyler's story serves Tyler. Later, we see a door covered in driver's licenses. We never see Raymond again. Raymond is reduced to a bureaucratic identification card. If he did not go back to school, he's dead because Tyler killed him. If he did go back to school, he's dead because he is no longer in control of his own life. He has been sacrificed to appease Tyler. Raymond's name and face are present, but Raymond's point of view is absent.
You had to give it to him.
No, we don't. Jack is there to put up the flimsiest defense, except Jack is not there. Tyler tells us he's there to reassure us that we're questioning this ridiculous situation along with Jack.
That wasn't funny. What the f*** was the point of that?
But Tyler is holding the gun. There's no actual voice of reason in this scene, only in the telling of it, for our sake. The underground fight clubs are supposedly formed in search of some truth, in search of freedom, but they are predicated on deception.
The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. Second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club.
By repeating that rule, Tyler is inviting us to break it. His cadence even punctuates the sentence as if to say, you do not, period, talk about Fight Club. Talk about Fight Club. do not, period. Talk about Fight Club. We are a group of people who want to break society's rules. Here are rules. Break them. And of course the rules are being broken. That's the only way the group can grow. The rule itself prompts members to disavow.
First rule is, I'm not supposed to talk about it.
But here I am, talking about it. Later, when Tyler calls out his followers for breaking the rules, it's not to punish them. Rather, after a brief interruption by an authority figure whose rules they've been breaking this whole time, Tyler rewards his men with a new development.
This week, each one of you has a homework assignment.
The beginning of Project Mayhem. Tyler not only expected people to talk publicly about Fight Club, he already had the next step of his plan ready for when more recruits showed up. Congratulations, you've all been promoted into the corporate structure of Project Mayhem. Also, Tyler only says do not talk about Fight Club 2 times. And as Tyler himself says...
Promise.
I just said I promise.
What? 3 times you promise.
For Tyler, being a loser is the first step towards being a winner. Whether it's Jack's status as a loser with no life, or literally losing a fight. So Tyler has a plan. Is the plan to succeed? To get a win under his belt? To strengthen his leadership position? No!
You're gonna start a fight. And you're gonna lose.
So Tyler recruits people who already feel like losers, then immediately gives them a losing task that will make them feel even more powerless. This increases their dependence on Tyler and increases his power base. Like the way the ringleaders of Gamergate target insecure gamers, then tell them that all of their problems are caused by women, people of color, and polygon titties not being big enough. Or Teal Swan, the YouTuber who preys on people with suicidal thoughts, gets them to pay her a big chunk of money for therapy that encourages them to kill themselves by telling them to visualize killing yourself. For Tyler, feeling like a loser is the basis for identity and the first step in reclaiming masculine superiority. This conflation of winning and losing parallels the way that neo-Nazis romanticized World War II, a contest the Nazis resoundingly lost. Or the way pro-slavery Americans romanticized the Civil War, a contest pro-slavery Americans resoundingly lost. In his 2006 essay about Fight Club and fascism, titled Masochism and Terror, Andrew Hewitt writes,
"This internalization of loss, this paradoxical affirmation of lack as the very basis of identity, marks the apotheosis of the novel assertion that it is precisely this loss of the war that is characteristically German. The fascist internalizes lack, ontologizes alienation, as the very condition of German subjectivity."
Being a loser becomes the basis for identity. Instead of feeling shame or regret about war and loss, the fascists double down, forming their identity in opposition to an other who has cheated them out of victory. Hewitt continues with his quote from Nietzsche.
"Every sufferer instinctively seeks a cause for his suffering. More exactly, an agent, still more specifically, a guilty agent who is susceptible to suffering. In short, some living thing upon which he can, on some pretext or other, vent his effects, actually or in effigy."
Tyler is the sufferer who points to society, consumerism, women, or whatever is convenient in the moment as the cause of his suffering. This is why he narrates Jack's life is so utterly pathetic, as suicidal, as practically a zombie. Tyler needs Jack to seem powerless because Tyler's going to show us, through Jack, the path to power. Assuming that Project Mayhem actually succeeds and resets debt to zero, which in itself is an absurd, fetishized plan, then Tyler will succeed in reordering society based around loss, based around lack. A lack of economics, a lack of structure, a lack of order. And he happens to be the leader of an organization that is ready to step in and impose its own economics, its own structure, its own order. Man, cops suck.
Fucking pigs.
But also, we're the cops. In 1999, when asked, "Did you see Tyler in terms of the literary device of the unreliable narrator?" Fincher said,
"Oh, he's totally unreliable."
Fight Club is extra frustrating because not only is our narrator unreliable, but Fincher himself is also an unreliable storyteller. Unlike Rashomon or The Last Jedi, where directors Kurosawa and Rian Johnson utilized unreliable narrators to blatantly call out the subjectivity of storytelling, Fincher indulges in subjective storytelling. He uses clever dialogue and flat acting to misdirect our attention.
"Did you know if you mix equal parts of gasoline and frozen orange juice concentrate, you can make napalm?"
"No, I did not know that. Is that true?"
"That's right."
So instead of thinking, "Oh my god, he's a terrorist," we, prompted by Jack's dialogue, think, "Oh wow, what a quirky guy. Oh wow, that Nazi so casually talks about ethnic cleansing. That's interesting." Fincher constructs his shots, visuals, and narrative to impose his order on the viewer.
"I just love the idea of this omniscience. Like the camera, it just goes over here kind of perfectly, and then it kind of goes over there kind of, and it stays with this person. There's none of that sort of documentary kind of feel to it. It's very much like what's happening was doomed to happen. And I like that as the sort of psychological underpinning."
Fincher's style does not open things up to interpretation or question. He has a point of view, an objective, and he will not allow you to stray. Just as Tyler, in telling his story, has a point of view, an objective, and he will not allow you to stray. Fincher utilizes a structure that director Peter Watkins has termed the monoform, a linear, predetermined format meant to drive the audience towards a specific conclusion.
"Which is simply a name I give to the basic structure of what we see on television, and in a majority sense, most of what we see in the commercial cinema today. Of course, it's a series of rapidly editing pictures, constantly displacing us from one thing to another, from one subject, one visual image, with all its associated metaphorical, symbolic, personal meanings, a different weight of information on the screen, different mass, different shape, different movement, and we're asked to deal with that, usually in 5, 6, or 7 seconds, which is the average cutting rate, and you change the next, and so on, so on, so on. This endless barrage of visual information, which is, of course, being accompanied by an audio barrage, all being thrust at the audience in a one-way monolinear push.
Encourages us to question the authority inherent in consumerism, we as an audience disavow that there are other forms of authority that we should question as well. For example, Tyler's authority and the police state he's trying to create. When it comes to questioning Tyler's authority, Jack, or our stand-in, only provides one very specific type of question.
What do you want me to do? You just want me to hit you?
Come on. Give me just one favor.
Why?
Hey, why do we need bunk beds?
Why? What are you talking about?
He frames his questions as a child asking a parent for their reasoning, instead of actually challenging Tyler's authority. Jack never challenges Tyler, never gives an alternative point of view, always asks for Tyler's justification, giving him another platform to lecture out of. And he always accepts that justification, prompting us to accept that justification.
You had to give it to him.
If Jack had a YouTube channel today, he'd probably be a centrist, insisting, "I'm just trying to hear both sides." Tyler dazzles new recruits with his cool, seemingly anti-authoritarian message while simultaneously stepping into the role of authority figure. Tyler uses a flat, cool tone of voice to seduce us, whether he's playing Tyler or playing Jack.
In a catastrophic emergency, you're taking giant panic breaths. Suddenly you become euphoric, docile. You accept your fate.
Tyler lulls us into feeling docile, into accepting the fate he's laid out for us. Brecht wrote about the alienating effects of certain kinds of meta-theater. Regarding an actor's tone of voice, Brecht said,
"The actor's way of speaking has to be free from parasonical sing-song and from all those cadences which lull the spectator so that the sense gets lost."
Tyler and Jack utilize the exact same kind of sing-song cadence that Brecht denounces.
"You are not a beautiful or unique snowflake. You are the same decaying organic matter as everything else."
The soundtrack to the movie, which you can buy at any major music retailer, even includes a bonus track. Listen as Tyler Durden coos a bunch of self-help advice at us.
It's only after you've lost everything that you're free to do anything.
If that isn't sing-songy, I don't know what is. Whereas Brecht's goal was to alienate us from the narrative, Tyler's goal is to pull us further into the narrative, further into his world. Tyler doesn't want to elevate the spectator, and seemingly neither does Fincher. The formal aspects of Fincher's films, more insider knowledge, such as editing, framing, and even the slightest camera moves, are ritualistically fetishized by cinephiles. For example, this YouTube video.
Did you see that? It's a very small thing, and it's easy to miss. What is it, exactly? Well, it's a camera move.
Fincher's perfectionism and artificiality are admired, to the point where any ethical implications about how these techniques are used become irrelevant. I don't mean to call out any YouTube channel specifically. Nerdwriter does great work. I'm trying to highlight how, when a director is able to trick us or seduce us with flashy film production techniques and visual effects, we invest more emotionally, not just in the narrative, but in the very means of production themselves. Film has always been a constructed medium, but the depth of Fincher's visual manipulation is unprecedented, especially since he uses these techniques for the most basic dialogue scenes. Even digital editing techniques that we would never spot with the naked eye are fetishized.
We're not just editing shots together anymore. We're editing pixel by pixel.
Humans are manipulated on screen pixel by pixel to manipulate us, the audience at home. Even though it feels kind of Big Brother-ish to me, film enthusiasts only show more reverence, more admiration for Fincher. Metz wrote about this type of film nerd, which he refers to as a cinema fetishist.
The cinema fetishist is the person who is enchanted at what the machine is capable of, at the theater of shadows, as such. For the establishment of his full potency for cinematic enjoyment, he must think at every moment of the force of presence the film has, and of the absence on which this force is constructed.
One might assume that behind-the-scenes videos, director commentaries, and YouTube videos explaining the meaning behind a movie would strip away the artifice, but to the cinephile, obtaining this sacred knowledge only adds to the depth of the film and their enjoyment. Just as we want to participate in the Tyler Durden power fantasy, so we want to participate in the Fincher as director power fantasy. Wouldn't it be fun to have all that control? All that control? All that control? All that control.
This one.
fascists than proto-fascists have always viewed humanity as disposable, as single-serving, as garbage. Of course, an ideology that views humans as compost would devise policies that lead to the glorification of death in battle, mass graves, and death camps. The blonde-haired, blue-eyed Superman is fetish object, denying the lack of perfection in all humans, denying the alienating, painful existence of living under an autocratic regime. Leni Riefenstahl, the Nazi documentarian, was hyper-aware of the fetish value of photogenic young men. While filming her Nazi propaganda film, she got upset that so many actual Nazis didn't live up to her aesthetic expectations. Prominent Nazi Albert Speer recalled,
"I was present when Riefenstahl, in a restaurant with her staff, was a little bit frank and made some mocking remarks about the bellies of the Nazi brown shirts not being so good for photographs or some such thing."
Riefenstahl mocked literal Nazis for not looking ideal enough. Riefenstahl biographer Stephen Bach adds, "Speer conspired with her to hide the brown shirt pot bellies she mocked behind thousands of swastika flags. In this instance, the ultimate fetish symbol for Nazis, the swastika, literally obscures actual pot-bellied Nazis. Nazis with pot bellies are present at the rally, but they're absent from Riefenstahl's film. Idealized Nazi imagery is present in Riefenstahl's film, but it's absent from reality. Tyler's body, actually very sexy Brad Pitt's body, obscures Tyler's true form, that of doughy Edward Norton. Tyler invites us to mock Gucci models, disavowing Brad Pitt's own highly sexualized body. In Fight Club, at least one conventionally unattractive member is allowed, who happens to be the only member who also dies a horrible, horrible death. Bob's body, which his fascist buddies considered grotesque and wrong, is recoded by those same buddies after his death, recycled into a perfect symbol of fascism.
In death, a member of Project Mayhem has a name."
Yes, Robert Paulson truly achieved glory by smashing the windows of a Starbucks coffee and then getting shot in the head. Tyler tells us he had it all.
"I had it all."
However, Tyler is aware he's missing something that society expects an adult male to have, a wife. His father even suggests this as a next step.
"Dad, now what?" He says, "I don't know. Get married."
But he refuses for abstract reasons.
"You can't get married. I'm a 30-year-old boy."
"I know I'm 30 years old and it's like time to get married, but I'm only 30 years old. I can't get married."
Tyler holds this anti-romance and anti-sex attitude, despite the constant sexual dialogue and imagery, especially homoerotic, phallic, and anal, splattered all over the film. But none of the sexual innuendo in the dialogue or imagery is ever titillating. It's almost always played either flatly or ironically.
"Check your prostate."
"I think I'm okay."
Powerful sexual dialogue is usually heard over scenes of violence.
"Sometimes all you can hear were the flat, hard, hacking sounds over the yelling. Or the wet choke when someone caught their breath and sprayed."
But any kind of emotional or vulnerable sexual dialogue is usually associated with impotence and disgust.
"You cry now."
"Strangers with this kind of honesty make me go a big rubbery one."
And in the void left behind in his mind where sex would exist, Tyler finds human suffering.
"I'm so close to the end and all I want is to get laid for the last time."
It's ironic that Chloe is talking about sex, because sex is not what arouses Jack here. He's getting off on her suffering. Immediately after that, while talking about the meetings, Tyler talks in a sing-song voice about how it makes him feel.
"Every evening I died, and every evening I was born again."
Tyler's referring to his orgasm. The pain he witnesses in these groups is the pornography he needs to reach climax. When he dies, he's experiencing la petite mort, the little death, which is a fancy term that means the sensation of orgasm as likened to death. When he's resurrected or rises again, he's talking about his dick. In framing the story, Fincher visually links sexual desire with physical illness.
Thank you.
forget your troubles and sin. Forget your sickness and death. Forget your weakness and death. Tell you what, cross the limit, get so high. Return for they start to cry. Now the weak must get strong. They're singing, oh, what a tribulation. The belly full, but we're hungry. A hungry mob is a hungry mob. A rain of all, but the dust is over. A pot of milk, but the food's not right. We're gonna jump to the music. We're chucking. Hey, we're chucking to the music. We're chucking.
It's very telling that Chloe and Bob are both the most emotionally honest and open characters in the entire movie, and the only characters who die in Tyler's telling of it. Not to mention, they are the characters most guilty of transgressing the gender binary. Bob with his massive breasts and missing testicles, and Chloe whose femininity has been ravaged by her illness, assuming she presented as feminine in the first place. God forbid Tyler acknowledges any kind of sexual curiosity outside the heteronormative binary. Tyler strives to make sex undesirable, to make sexual pleasure feel unattractive and pathetic. It's possible to read Fight Club as homoerotic. However, there's no actual love or attraction between men. Despite the constant homoerotic imagery, he seems completely uninterested in any kind of sex. The most homoerotic moments are between Tyler and Tyler. Even Marla seems like a toy at best. Marla is portrayed as disgusting, haggard, unkempt. Fincher does everything he can to make us feel that Marla is stinky, and once again links sexual desire to physical illness.
This is cancer, right?
Her sex scenes are so depraved.
I haven't been like that since grade school.
So extreme or so abstract, they're devoid of any conventionally erotic imagery. This is not sex for pleasure. This is sex as performance. Tyler was performing heterosexuality. Sex for the sake of telling his friends, I banged that chick.